Hey everyone, I'm just going to give it another minute or two. Okay, hi everyone. Welcome. I'm going to officially call the meeting to order. It's 12:02, and I will hand it over to Marcy for the roll call.
Hello. Okay. People are still trickling in. Let's see.
Yeah.
Brian. Yep. No, we're good. I'll also check to see who comes on after I do the roll call. But yep, Brian Arnold. Marcy Benda's here. Michael Boggs.
Present.
Frank Cantone. Sean Chang.
Here.
Erica Crawley. Rebecca Dillon, Bethany Dixon, I saw her. Yep, Jamie Doss, Thomas Hanbury,
Here.
Don Hinshaw, Erica is here. I just saw her. Kyle Carnuta.
Here, sorry.
Oh, you're good. Jeremy Cruiser.
Present.
Sophie Lanchez, Christine Mahoney,
Hello.
hi, Anne Morse,
Present.
Kevin Phipps,
Here.
Stephanie Rizzou,
Present.
Yvonne Solis Cruz,
Here.
Phil Sroka,
Present.
Kate Supron, Deborah
I'm here.
Sarine. I see you. Deborah Serine.
Here.
Wendy Tree.
Present.
Jana Van Houten is here.
Present.
Danielle Wierson. Wierson.
Wierson, here.
Wierson. Sorry. I do it every time. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Marcy. Okay, now I'm going to go into the land acknowledgement. So Cornell University is located on the traditional homelands of the Gayokono. The Gayokono are members of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, an alliance of six sovereign nations with a historic and contemporary presence on this land. The Confederacy precedes the establishment of Cornell University, New York State, and the United States of America. We acknowledge the painful history of Gayokono dispossession and honor the ongoing connection of Gayokono people, past and present, to these lands and waters. I would like at this time to see if anyone has any late additions to the agenda. Okay. Without any additions, we're going to move into approval of the minutes. Let's see here. I saw an email from Eric today. Let me see if I can put those two links into the chat. Just one moment.
I'll do that, Jana.
Oh, thank you. Just got it. So we'll take a moment and review those. And when anyone is ready to, if you've read it all, I welcome a motion to approve both of the minutes.
Motion to approve the February 7th and February 21st minutes.
Seconded.
Great. Thank you, Marcy and Wendy. Okay. Now I would like to welcome Dan Moss, who is the Associate Director of Emergency Management, and he is going to be presenting to us today. So I'll let you take it over from here, Dan. Thank you.
And thank you. So just checking you can see my screen and hear me.
Yes, everything looks great.
Okay. I did a presentation yesterday and shared the wrong window. So I want to make sure you can see the right one. So good afternoon, I guess it's afternoon. Little about myself. I've been at Cornell a long time. I was an undergrad, and I've been here ever since. I started out as an emergency responder and have done a variety of things over the years. There's quite a few folks I see here that names I recognize. So some folks that I've probably run across in my decades at Cornell. We're going to talk today about the Office of Emergency Management, the services we provide, hopefully provide you with some information that's useful to you, that you can take back to your units. If at any time anyone wants this presentation for their unit, I'm more than happy to bring it out to them. Things going. So, I'm sure if I'm looking all around, it's because the camera's here, you're all over here, and my presentation's there. But, you're all aware of the size and scope of Cornell. What a lot of people don't realize is we're more like a small city than just a university. We make our own power. We have our own municipal services, such as police, emergency response, facilities and grounds, things like that, make our own water. So there's more to it than just teaching classes, service, things like that. There's a lot that goes into keeping us running. And emergency management is here to support that during times of crisis and make sure we're prepared and ready to deal with those issues that might impact our campus operations, our campus community. We're part of the Division of Public Safety. Hang on just a second if I can. Nope, I can't. Yep, move that. Division of Public Safety, which was formed a little less than 2 years ago. The division contains the Cornell University Police Department, our community response team, the Access Control Group and Security Group, Clery Compliance Office. The Office of Emergency Management, Cornell University Emergency Medical Service, which is a student-run EMS squad. In addition to being the Associate Director of Emergency Management, I'm also the advisor for Cornell EMS. And then also the Public Safety Communications Center, the 911 Dispatch Center for the campus. And coming sometime within the next year is the Campus Service Team, which you'll hear about, I think, at a later time when that program is more finalized and getting off the ground. So the Office of Emergency Management is responsible for our emergency management program. So what is that? It's basically we follow the same emergency management model as most municipalities. We focus on preparedness, prevention, mitigation activities for our community. And when things go bad, we deal with the response and recovery from whatever the crisis is. So most of our time is spent above the red line, hoping that things are going well. But when things go bad and we end up below the red line, we're here to help facilitate and manage that response. Our emergency preparedness program has a variety of aspects. We do training. We do exercises to practice and prepare for emergencies. We develop a lot of preparedness resources for the community, for the emergency responders. And we're involved in planning for a lot of our large major events, such as commencement, slope day, reunion, homecoming. We get involved in significant emergency incidents to the campus, and we're involved in continuity of operations planning, helping units on campus prepare to keep their operations going during a crisis. And then during emergencies and incidents, we support the emergency responders who are out in the field and the other operations that are going on. We support the folks who are sending emergency messages to the campus. We think about what are the things that are coming up. You know, the folks are focused on the fire that's going on right now in a building. We're thinking one, two, three steps ahead. What happens after the fire is put out? What happens to the people who have currently been displaced from that facility? What are the other impacts that might be caused by this emergency? We help units maintain their continuity of operations, their ability to keep providing the services during the crisis. And then when things calm down, we help support recovery operations if necessary. And we'll talk a little bit more about some of that later on. We're an office of two people. Myself as the associate director, Nate Hunter is our emergency manager. You can contact us either through the Public Safety Dispatch Center at the standard 607-255-1111 number. Nate's and my phone numbers and email addresses are listed in the directory, so you can contact us there. And then we have the generic oem@cornell.edu email address for the office. We're responsible for the emergency website, the emergency.cornell.edu site. And we'll talk a little bit later about what are some of the resources here. But this is the site we try to send everybody to during an emergency. Any emergency messages you receive will always have this site listed in them. On the right-hand side, if there's either a Cornell alert or a crime alert that's current, it'll show up on the right side. And during emergencies, we will take over this center column and replace the preparedness information with information specific to the emergency and try to expand on what's going on, what resources are available, things like that. If you've ever looked at this during a winter weather closure, you would see that we're listing like links to TCAT, links to what dining services are open, what's the library doing, things like that, so our community can access those resources and know what's going on. One thing I want to point out is, and people are still confused by this, the Office of Emergency Management used to be part of Environment, Health, and Safety. We are no longer part of that department. That department during the reorganization was moved to the Division of Facility Services. And these are the services they provide. So if you're looking for support for general workplace health and safety, environmental issues, fire code issues, research safety, things like that, you need to call the Office of Environment or the Environment and Health and Safety Department. And their contact information is down there in the corner. They do have emergency responders on duty, and emergencies should always be reported to the Public Safety Dispatch Center, Communication Center. We'll talk a little bit more later on about how to do that and what the differences are when you call different phone numbers. But I just want to stress, we're still located in the Environment, Health, and Safety building out at Palm Road. We have an agreement to stay in here. We've got facilities here, but we're no longer part of this department. We work closely with them on a regular basis. We respond with them. But if you've got health and safety concerns, you should be going to them and not to emergency management. So incident coordination, on a day-to-day basis, there's already folks who are managing our response to emergencies on the campus. At the county level is the County 911 Center, run by Tompkins County. On a campus level is the Cornell Public Safety Communications Center. These folks deal with taking 911 calls, non-emergency calls, dispatching emergency resources, coordinating responses by other groups, and they handle the day-to-day activities of our emergency responders and others. The county is responsible for issuing Tompkins siren alerts. Those are the local community alerts. And if you haven't signed up for them, I encourage you to go to the emergency website, and there's a link to emergency notifications. There's a community notifications section where you can find the sign up information for them. And then our Public Safety Communication Center on campus is responsible for sending our emergency alerts, which are branded as Cornell Alert, and our crime alerts, the Clary timely warning to notify the community of potential threats to them. What happens when you call for help? Well, one thing people don't realize is depending on what phone you're using to call for help, if you call 911, dial just 911, you may get a different dispatch center. Campus phones, if you dial 911, the traditional landline type phones, they will ring into our Cornell Dispatch Center. If you have a Ring Central phone, one of the voice over IP phones, if you are on campus and you're using either a desk set on campus or you're using the app on your computer and you've set your location to an office or a location on campus, it will go to the Cornell 911 center. If you're, say, at home using your computer and you've correctly set Ring Central so that it knows you're off campus, at home, a coffee shop, wherever, it will route that call to the local 911 center. So it's really important that when you're working off campus, if you're using Ring Central on your computer, that you set the location so the emergency call goes to the right place. Let's say I'm at home in Aetna in Tompkins County and I still have my Ring Central set to say I'm in the office. It's going to route that call to campus instead of to the county like it should. And if you call 911 from a cell phone in Tompkins County, you will get the Tompkins County 911 Center, even if you're in the middle of our campus here. So if you ever need to call the Cornell Public Safety Communication Center, the 10-digit number is 607-255-1111. And if you dial that number from any phone, it will always take you to the on-campus 911 center. And if you use any of the Cornell Blue Light phones, the outdoor phones, or the indoor, just lift to call or push the button to call, those go directly to public safety, along with any communications you do through the Rave Guardian app. We'll talk about that a little later. They also go to our public safety center. So emergency management structure, what happens after you call 911? Well, the dispatch center will send first responders to assist you. If you happen to call 911 from a cell phone on campus and you get the county, don't worry about it. They will dispatch responders and then they will call our public safety center, let us know about the incident that's going on, and send campus resources as well. If you can call the campus 911 center directly, that's better because it gets our campus resources responding a little bit faster. So these are the folks who come to the scene and deal with emergency response. They take command of the incident. They use what's called the incident command system to manage their operations. So there's an organized structure. Everybody knows who's in charge. And they manage those on-scene incident operations. They're the ones who make a decision about, oh, there's really an active threat to life. We need to send an emergency message right now and let the public know they need to take protective actions. So they would be responsible for that. On campus, we have a variety of different emergency first responders. We have Cornell University Emergency Medical Service, that student-run EMS organization that I'm the advisor of. We have environment, health, and safety responders, and then we have Cornell Police. They're the traditional fire, EMS, police responders you would think of in the community. In addition to that, we have our community response team, which is a trauma-informed support group. They come and they support folks who are impacted by crises, help connect them with the resources they need, whether it's additional mental health support or other things that they can do for them. And then people don't think of it, but our shift mechanics from facility services that are out there able to respond nights, weekends, immediately to deal with facility related crises, we consider them first responders as well. And then locally, we rely on the local emergency services to support our on-campus responders. Most of the campus is served by Bangs Ambulance and the Ithaca Fire Department. Ithaca Fire Department is the only career department in the county. All the other departments are volunteer. There's multiple ambulance services that have a mix of volunteer and career staff. And then there's portions of our properties that are covered by some of the volunteer departments, such as Lansing, Cayuga Heights, Varna, Dryden, Freeville, places like that. A little further off the central campus area, though. And then our police are supported both by the Tompkins County Sheriff, the City of Ithaca Police, and when necessary, New York State Police. So these folks on a day-to-day basis deal with our typical regular frequency routine emergencies. These are the day-to-day incidents that they handle on their own without any additional support from emergency management or other response organizations. Your typical medical and injury calls, alarm activations, minor fires, minor hazardous materials incidents, property crimes, arsons, short utility outages, our typical snowstorms and thunderstorms, things that don't impact our overall operations, that don't require lots of other support. They might request, our first responders might request additional support from the university shops, from facilities. They might request support from transportation services, from our building care folks, but usually it doesn't go beyond those resources to deal with the crises. On an individual level, we want folks to understand that they're not first responders. We don't expect individuals to be first responders, that we expect you to understand the emergency action guide and what to do in case of an emergency, who to call for help, and if you've had training, providing help to your colleagues, the rest of the community until help gets there. Okay, and there's trainings that we'll talk about later that you can use to help prepare you better for responding to emergencies. Our emergency action guide is on our emergency website. It's on the left-hand side of every page on the site, along with there's a link that will take you to the full guide, which will give you this whole list on that site. In addition, there's facility emergency plans posted in all buildings. These are the responsibility of Environment, Health, and Safety, the University Fire Marshal's Office. These are posted around the buildings, wherever they're required by building code, along with evacuation maps. So they provide the same information that's included in that emergency action guide, but it's just a brief selection of the more common emergencies you would encounter. Going to play a short preparedness video. This video is available on our website, and I encourage you to encourage others to watch it. Please let me know if the sound is not coming through. It should be. I've shared it. It's about 3 minutes.
Cornell's Ithaca campus is a residential community where students live and study, faculty and staff research and work, and visitors explore and attend events. Each of us must do our part to have a safe, welcoming community where everyone can thrive. Cornell's public safety team and emergency responders are here 24 hours a day to serve and protect the community. If you see something, say something. Report emergencies or suspicious activity by calling 911. When there is a serious incident that poses an immediate threat to the health and safety of students or employees on campus, such as severe weather or other active threat to life, the university will send a Cornell alert message. Cornell alert messages include important information about how to stay safe. Stay attentive for additional messages and updates. Follow all Cornell alert instructions until you receive an all clear message. For incident updates and to familiarize yourself with safety terms and actions, visit emergency.cornell.edu. Building evacuation is required anytime the fire alarm sounds or an evacuation announcement is made. In the event of an evacuation, immediately leave the building or area. Turn off equipment and secure hazardous operations if possible. Avoid using elevators and alert anyone around you who might not be aware of the evacuation. During certain emergencies, it may be safer to stay indoors. You may be asked to shelter in place because of severe weather, a hazardous materials incident, or other active threat to life. The most appropriate shelter area will vary depending on the hazard. Select a room or area away from windows and glass, exterior walls and doors. If you're outside, quickly find shelter in the nearest building. Cornell Police follow the Department of Homeland Security's model of run, hide, fight to prepare individuals for active threat to life situations. The first thing to do in the presence of any danger is to remove yourself from the situation and do it quickly. Call 911 when it is safe to do so. Obey officers, keep your hands visible and free of objects. If you are unable to get out, do everything you can to make yourself safe where you are. Lock your door. Work with others to move heavy objects and furniture to block entry. Turn off lights, close blinds, and silence phones. Conceal yourself as much as possible. As a last resort, if you're face-to-face with a threat, use anything available to improvise weapons such as sharp objects, fire extinguishers, coffee mugs, laptops, or books. It's important to be aware of your surroundings and report suspicious behavior or activities. In addition to calling 911, you can use the nearest Blue Light emergency phone or the Rave Guardian app to directly text the Public Safety Dispatch Center for emergency assistance. For non-emergencies, you can anonymously report information about a crime through Rave Guardian or the Silent Witness Program on the Cornell Police website. The Division of Public Safety offers a variety of crime prevention, personal security, and emergency preparedness trainings and outreach programs for individuals and groups. By working together, we can keep our campus community safe. You can learn more at emergency.cornell.edu. Cornell's Ithaca campus.
There we go. So another preparedness tool that we have out there is the weekly Division of Public Safety email. You should all get that automatically from Dave Honan, our Associate Vice President. And then we have a variety of preparedness resources on our website. There's a menu with a whole link of resources, including a preparedness section. If you scroll down on the page below the Emergency Action Guide, there's a whole menu of other preparedness information, including a preparedness checklist that takes you through a series of pages of things you can do to better prepare yourself for emergencies, both here on campus and at home. There's links. It includes emergency preparedness training in that list, with links to CPR and first aid training through Cornell EMS and EHS, fire safety training through EHS, personal security and active shooter awareness training through Cornell Police. And then emergency management provides training for college leadership, along with our emergency response and our incident management partners on emergency management. There's resources for facility representatives on what we expect facilities to do, especially larger venues such as libraries, community centers, public places with public spaces such as atrium spaces, things we want facility representatives to be aware of so they can better prepare the facility and so they know what we expect during a major incident. There's academic preparedness resources for our faculty partners about what they can do to better prepare for the classroom so they know what to do when there's an emergency in their teaching. There's a whole variety of weather preparedness resources there, both winter and for the rest of the year around, summertime as well, along with information about what happens when we close, who makes those decisions, a whole FAQ about that information, links to where to find weather forecasts and receive weather alerts, things like that. I'm proud to say that Cornell is a storm-ready university. We've been recognized by the National Weather Service for the programs we have to both monitor the weather and then plans to take action when severe weather is expected. Emergency mass notification. I talked about this earlier. We brand our emergency notifications as Cornell alert messages. They're sent out anytime there's an immediate threat to the health and safety of the community. So an active threat, such as somebody with a weapon, someone causing immediate violence, a tornado, things like that, that people need to take action right away to protect themselves from that hazard. If you go to our website, you go to the emergency alert section, there's information on how to update your personal contact information so you receive the text messages. We also encourage folks to sign up for Rave Guardian. There's links on our website to the download Rave Guardian for phones. The reason we encourage that is with SMS text messages, we're limited to 160 characters. Whereas with email messages, messages to our RSS feed on our website, messages to the Rave Guardian app, messages to campus signage, those can be longer. So if you have the Rave Guardian app, even if you're signed up for SMS text messages, you're not limited to what's in that shorter 160 character message. With Rave Guardian, you will see the bigger message that we send to emails, which will typically have more information about the hazard and what to do because of it. We just can only fit so much in that limited text message. So what happens when we have to deal with these non-routine incidents, the kinds of things where we're sending out emergency alerts, things that go beyond our normal first responders, where we have an extended incident, where we have multiple casualties, we have to bring in additional support such as utilities, we have to evacuate or shelter people, we might have roadways that are closed, there might be press showing up, we might have to do a larger scale evacuation where there's lots of people on the road. That's when emergency management gets involved. It's when it goes beyond the day-to-day stuff. And we're talking low frequency or very low frequency, but very high impact incidents. Things that are affecting more than just a couple people, a small group, you know, serious injuries or deaths, larger fires that cause us to have to evacuate and leave a major building unoccupied, major hazardous material spills that get outside of the room of the spill, major utility or technology issues. Things like 2016, we had a drought that had the potential to impact our water supply, the air quality issues we had last year from the wildfires up north, and then the really big incidents like infectious disease, active threats, terrorism, ice storms, hurricanes, major hate crimes, things that have a broader impact to our community. To deal with this, we have a plan, our emergency operations plan. It's called All Hazards, meaning it's generic. It's not specific for every kind of incident. It's set up in a capabilities format so that we can apply it to all kinds of issues, even issues we haven't thought about in the past, hazards that we're not aware of. It contains the roles and responsibilities for the different people who would respond, contains the management structure, and some overarching strategies that we're going to use to deal with the crisis, and a list of our capabilities that we have primarily from the emergency support functions to deal with different types of issues and needs. And it's available for anybody to read on our website. It's up to version 8. Right now, version 7 is on the site. We need to replace that, but it's there. There's no major changes to the new version. So anyone who wants to look at it and better understand how we respond. It lays out these support functions, which are really services that we can use. They're different types of services we can pull out of our cadre and apply them to the crisis. We don't always need all of them. For example, animal care. If there's no animals involved, no university-owned animals involved in the crisis, then that group doesn't need to be activated. But they're different services, and we pull them out as we need them to address the crisis. When we bring those folks from the emergency support functions together, we form what we call an incident management team. That group is made up of either representatives from the emergency support functions, along with academic and research representatives, representatives from risk management and insurance, and then other university departments as needed. It might have a representative from a specific college if there's a single college that's impacted, things like that. And that group really coordinates the services from those support functions. They support the first responder needs. We're not going out and putting out the fire, but we're calling the folks on the scene and saying, what do you need? What support do you need sent to the scene? What other resources do you need? We deal with follow-up messaging. There might have been an initial message or two issued by the Public Safety Dispatch Center, but after they've sent a couple of those, someone else needs to step in and take over emergency messaging. They're dealing with the responders in the field. They're dealing with the public calling in, reporting other problems or asking for information. So someone else needs to take over sending those follow-up Cornell alert messages out to the community. We coordinate the response to secondary impacts. So we let the primary responders deal with the initial problem, and we look at what are the bigger issues, the secondary impacts that need to be addressed, and try to take some things off the plates of the first responders so they can focus on the emergency. And then we work on gathering information about what's going on and sharing that with our partners who are dealing with the crisis, with the community when we can. And then we share it upwards as well to the incident leadership team. So the leadership team is composed of specific vice presidents, our general counsel, vice provosts, and then the associate vice president of public safety, the president's chief of staff, the police chief, and the senior director of environment, health, and safety. This group's responsible not for making operational decisions like the incident management team and the first responders, but they're making the bigger picture policy type decisions. So issuing university statements, which are different from emergency alerts, these are statements by the university about what's going on, what we're doing, issuing condolences, things like that. They might be asked to make fiscal authorizations for expenses that go beyond what's normal for the incident management team. They might be asked to make policy decision recommendations, like do we close the university? Give us some more strategic prioritizations and guidance. If we have to say we can save this building but not this building, which one is the higher priority? And they're responsible for communicating with the presidents, the deans, and others. And then the president's office ultimately has authority for policy decisions, approving things that are recommended by the incident leadership team or suggesting changes, communicating with the board of trustees, providing strategic guidance when we get to the recovery phase of an incident. And unless the president delegates it to another vice president, the president ultimately is the spokesperson for the university. So a lot of folks just think about emergency response when it comes to incidents, and they don't realize that response to incidents is actually, it has its own life cycle. An emergency occurs, and yes, there's a response to deal with that. But at the same time, someone is typically impacted by that crisis. And those folks who are impacted have to start thinking about, how does this impact my operations, especially operations that are essential to the functioning of the university? And it may be that while the crisis is going on, these folks have to activate their continuity plans to continue providing those services to the university. For example, if we had a fire in Barton Hall, where the Public Safety Communications Center is located, we can't stop answering 911 calls from our community. So they would have to implement their continuity plan to keep their dispatch operations going. They'd relocate to their backup center, they'd send people over there, and they used alternate means to deal with that. And then at some point, we've dealt with the emergency, the response operations are slowing down, and someone has to start thinking about recovery. How do we get back to normal and either rebuild or in some way recover from this crisis? And the thing to remember is you may need to continue your continuity operations while you're recovering. And that's why there's this overlap between the different phases of an emergency. Because, you know, you may be continuing your continuity operations for 30 days while you're getting your normal operations back online and working. The continuity activities becomes really important when we have to close certain portions of the university for something like a weather event, a winter storm. There's certain services and functions that are essential that we still have to keep providing. We've got to keep housing students. We've got to keep feeding students. There's plants, animals that need to be cared for. There's emergency services that need to continue. Utilities have to stay on. We can't just shut those down because we've got a snow day. So continuity really focuses on our ability to deliver those services during and after some kind of disruption. And we think about it. Nate Hunter is our continuity planner, in addition to all his other jobs. And he works with units on campus to think about what are the strategies they're going to use if, and it really comes down to three things. We're missing our people because everybody went out for sushi as a group and we all got bad sushi and now everybody's sick and we can't do the job. We don't have our building or space. Come in this morning and oops, a meteor has hit the EHS building and now we don't have this building to use anymore. What are we going to do? Or we don't have our resources. Normally we need IT resources, and for some reason Amazon Web Services is down. The server farm at CIT has a problem. What are we going to do as a backup plan to keep providing the services to the community that we need to? And Nate goes through this with departments and units, helping them figure out what are the different plans, what's the plan B you're going to use? You know, are you going to change the service or the function you're providing? Are you going to reduce it? reallocate resources to support the important services, stop doing it entirely. There's cases where you can stop doing a function for a certain amount of time before it comes an issue. Alternate spaces, alternate resources or processes, moving people around in job responsibilities, or maybe you're able to keep doing it without any change. A good example I use is the EHS hazardous waste and hazardous materials response. Okay, if there's an issue and EHS can't pick up the hazardous waste from labs on campus, that's something that can be suspended for a certain amount of time because labs have space to continue to accumulate those waste materials before they have to be taken away for disposal. Whereas we can't discontinue our response to hazardous material spills. Someone drops a bottle, someone's got to go clean that up. So one service we can suspend for a certain amount of time before it impacts our campus constituents. Another one we have to maintain all the time, even when we're short on resources, so that we can respond to an emergency. We've developed resources for the academic community to help them with their continuity planning for classroom disruptions. And then we go out and we work with units to do preparedness exercises, giving them a scenario saying, if this happens, what's your plan? And then we walk through the plan with them and make sure they've thought about all the different impacts, whether it's a weather impact, personnel impact, facility impact. What have you done to prepare? Have you prepared your employees? Have you talked about this? What are the functions you need to keep doing in this situation? And Marcy gave me a few questions that folks might be interested in, such as what role do we have during campus threats? In general, we're not first responders. We're here to support the first responders. So typically during a campus threat, we're working with them to think about what is the messaging that might need to go out to the campus. We're helping them gather information and intelligence. We're bringing together executives and incident management team members if needed to support the response, and try to help folks figure out what exactly is the threat, what are the concerns, what are the needs, what does the community need to know, and making sure all those pieces are working together, that everyone's getting the information they need. During severe weather events, emergency management is responsible for monitoring and watching for severe weather events. We work closely with the National Weather Service. We get briefings from them on a regular basis. We attend their weekly briefings throughout the year, getting intelligence and information on what are the weather hazards expected during the next week? What are the major storms that we're seeing? We'll distribute that information to our campus partners. And when necessary, we're responsible for identifying storms that might impact our campus operations and require a closure decision. And then we bring together both the operational folks to determine, is this storm going to be something we can keep up with? Can grounds keep the sidewalks, the roadways, the surfaces clear enough that the campus is safe, or do we need to consider closing the university until the weather abates and the grounds crews can make the campus safe again? And we're responsible for bringing those decision makers together. And then campus protests and disturbances, it's similar to the campus threats in that the Dean of Students Office, Cornell Police are typically the ones on the ground who are going, monitoring the situation, trying to encourage correct behavior that is not disrupting university operations, that's in line with the guidelines for expressive activities. But we're also monitoring and understanding, you know, are there any secondary impacts? We've had protests in the past, not in recent history, but a while ago, where folks plopped down in the middle of Feeney Way and Tower Road intersection and completely blocked off that intersection. And then there's a lot of coordination that has to happen, notifying the community that don't try to drive that way, contacting bus services, notifying emergency responders, things like that, getting the word out like that. So that's how we get involved. We're trying to collect information, share it with our partners, make sure folks know about the operational impacts. That's my presentation. I encourage you to explore the emergency management website. Contact us if you have questions, and I'm happy to answer any questions you have right now. And I hope that was what you were looking for, Marcy.
That was perfect. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Dan. And Anne, go right ahead with your question.
Thanks so much, Dan. And just a shout out for the help that you've given to the Cornell summer events in the past, predicting weather for us. Really appreciate it. Two questions. One of them was if you have any update on the community response team beyond what you shared. And the second was there's a weekly email that goes out, very helpful, about sort of the emergency response and crisis team for that week. And I'm wondering if there's a way to get new staff who need to get that email on that email list, or if what I've always done is just shared it as people onboard. But
so are you talking about the email from University Relations?
Yes.
So you need to contact University Relations to get people on that distribution list. So we're on that along with others in public safety. The public safety dispatch center is on it as well. But yeah, you'd need to contact University Relations. And I honestly can never remember who the right person is, even when I have to send updates to change who's on this week for emergency management. When it comes to the community response team, and I'm going to share another screen here, my suggestion, whoops. Are you seeing this page here about community response team? My suggestion is you go to the publicsafety.cornell.edu site and click on the community response team link. And this gives you a little more in-depth description of what they do. My other suggestion is contact Angie Tretolini. I think that's her last name. I'm terrible with names. But Angie, I'm sure, would be happy to come talk about the community response team and what they do, what services they provide, what their current schedule is, things like that.
Great. Thank you. I'm going to go to Kate real quick. I think Kate had a contact in University Relations.
Yeah, I did. And I was getting ready to message Anne, but Melissa Schaffmaster is the director of Stratcom. So she would be the person to reach out to, and you could CC Ted Boscha, B-O-S-C-A.
Great. Thank you, Kate. And so I'm going to go to Kyle and then Michael.
If I could just comment. So that list is not something that is sent to every university employee. It's specifically folks who are in a role that need to receive that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm not saying that would do it, but they're the, I would imagine,
yeah,
the list.
Yeah, they're the gatekeepers. I think I was more commenting to Laureen's comment, yeah, in the chat there.
Yeah.
Thank you for that clarification. And Kyle.
Sure. Thank you, Dan, for this. I think you clarified a lot of what your office does that I thought you did X, Y, or Z, but actually it's other groups that do it. So I'm not even sure if this is the right question for you, but maybe you can point us in the right direction. And actually, it's kind of related to Laureen's point as well, that it just seems like a lot of these resources about emergency preparedness are kind of owned by different departments or different offices within Cornell. They're not centralized, which makes it hard for employees or students. I was a student previously at Cornell to find. And a lot of those resources are kind of opt in. You have to go and look for them, as opposed to this being something that we're exposed to at the very beginning as some kind of like a training. And I know the incident, I think it was like two Octobers ago, where there may have been an active shooter on campus, but actually there wasn't, caused a lot of confusion, especially amongst like TAs and international students or international TAs, for whom terms like shelter in place, it doesn't mean the same thing for them as it might mean for an American who grew up doing active shooter drills in school. So there is a lot of confusion around the terminology that's being used. So I'm just wondering, how can this information be centralized, or perhaps be a default that it's information that people receive as soon as they join the organization? Maybe it's even an annual training, because it's just so, this information is so important, but it does seem very hard to find and like stay on top of.
So that's part of the purpose of the emergency management website. And we try to encourage people to go there. That video was actually developed as a result of those incidents 2 years ago. It's definitely not gotten the outreach that we like. Dave's used it in some of his, especially his fall messages to the community. I'm not sure what the click-through rate is, though, on those messages and how often people actually read them. And that's, we've tried to use that as much as we can to get that information out. And if you look at last week's message that talks about the previous threat that we had, he's linked to a lot of things on the emergency website. We've tried, I recognize that a lot of these services, especially the preparedness services and training, are provided by different departments based on the subject matter responsibility. And that's why we've tried to consolidate them. There's a single preparedness training page on the emergency website that points you to, okay, you want first aid training? Here's the link to the CU Learn courses that you need. You want personal safety and run, hide, fight training? Here's the link to Cornell Police to be able to do that. I would love to have additional staff in emergency management so we could do more outreach efforts. Community education and outreach is one of those things that's been on our menu for a long time. We just don't have the staff time to get out there and do more of it. But like I said, I'm more than happy to bring this to department meetings, student groups, anyone who wants to hear about this. We can shrink it down so it's more focused on preparedness only. Right now, Nate Hunter, he actually tomorrow has a presentation. Today's presentation has the last slides from his presentation he's doing for the entire ILR staff. And he's been working with the ILR school, their dean and their dean's office on a lot of preparedness stuff. They're a more active college when it comes to that, but some of it depends on the specific college and their interest in doing things like this.
Cool. Thank you for that. Yep. Thank you. That is very helpful.
And if you, anything you can do to share this video, it's right there on the front page of the website. And hopefully that, you know, answers people's questions and get them pointed in at least the right direction.
Cool. Thank you. And I know that our chat is not part of the record. So I just want to say as a follow-up to that, that I would perhaps recommend elevating this as an issue for the EA as something that we should talk about further. Thanks.
Okay. And in the being mindful of time, I'm going to let Michael ask a question and then Jeremy, and then we have to move on. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. As a facilities guy and one of your disciples on the front lines during all the volunteering I do, I was curious about the backup 911 center at East Hill Plaza, if that's done yet, and then the East Hill Fire, or not, yeah, the Collegetown Fire Station and the status of that.
So the backup 911 center, which if folks aren't aware, Cornell and Tompkins County have gone into a shared agreement to build a backup 911 center that'll serve both dispatch centers. That's still under construction. I believe it has something like a June finalization date. And the Collegetown Fire Station, which is Station 2 for the Ithaca Fire Department, replacing the old Station 2, formerly Station 9, which I'm intimately familiar with. I was a volunteer firefighter with Ithaca for 30 years with Company 9. That's under construction. They had some road closures so they could do tree removal. And if you drive down Dryden Road at the corner of Elmwood, you will see a big empty lot where that construction has started. I'm guessing that's got at least another year of construction to go. I don't think they've started more than clearing the lot yet.
Thank you. Jeremy?
Maybe you answered this already, Dana, so I apologize that I missed it. Has there been contact with like Christine Lovely about adding some of this to the onboarding packet that's provided new hires?
We've had some discussion over the years. Nothing recently. As far as students go, students in their registration process, the key thing that was added there was a screen that encourages them to go update their personal contact information so they can enroll for Cornell Alerts. And during onboarding, I'm told that employees are walked through that process as well and encouraged to enter a personal phone number to receive Cornell alerts. But I'm not sure if they're showing people the video or pointing out the emergency website or anything like that.
Okay, thanks.
Hey,
and as I said, if I had some staff, I'd probably consider sending them to work on creating a CU Learn emergency preparedness video training that we could post online. It's just a challenge. You all know Frank Cantone. He's a member, retiree member of the EA. He was a former director of EHS, or I'm sorry, of emergency management. When Frank was here, we had three people. A couple years before that, we had up to five people, a one-year position and an intern. And right now we're making do with Nate and I. And Dave's working to try and get us more staff, but you know the challenges to that.
And this might be a space where the EA can provide a little bit of additional help. So good opportunity to discuss that later.
Yeah, if you want to discuss that, I'd say talk with Dave Honan directly about how, what efforts you can do to help support that. I do know that we report to Chris Cowan, the executive vice president, and he's expressed support. Is just a challenge of, takes time here. So thank you all for this opportunity, and, email us if we can provide anything else.
Great. Thank you, Dan. Really appreciate your time today. Okay, so now we're going to head on into committee reports. So Marcy with the executive committee.
Yep, I'll try to be real quick. We're just talking about future discussions, possible people leader training, finance and budget, economic snapshot, also discussing today's meeting. Other committees will have a little bit more information too, but thank you.
Great, thanks Marcy. Okay, and Sophie with the communications.
Hi everyone. So last week, EA Voice went out February 29th. And then on March 1st, the spring elections announcement came out. So spring elections are open for EA. So let everyone know. And we also emailed it to all staff as well. We'll be working on this month's EA Voice. We'll need another spotlight. So if anyone would like to be this month's EA spotlight, let me know. And I could also give you examples of past EA spotlights as well.
Thanks, Sophie. All right, so please reach out to Sophie if you'd like to be in the spotlight. If not, she will pick someone randomly. Okay, and Jeremy with the Education and Development Committee.
So we had some updates during our last meeting, then some lively conversation around staff social media use, a couple of different topics under there. I think we're going to continue that conversation and look towards actions that we might bring before the assembly later. We also talked about concerns with the non-degree seeking employee registration process, and related to that, the EDP registration process and the tax implications for staff around that and how it's communicated, something else that we're going to continue developing.
Great. Thank you. And Christy with the Welfare Committee.
Hello. We had a meeting earlier today. We hosted Linda Kroll Howe, Maria Wolf, and Ruth Katz from the Employee Experience Team. Very, very interesting discussion around internal transfers, surveys that they have initiated starting this January that will be done every 3 months, and the results, very preliminary results of that, and the programs that they're developing as a result. Great discussion. I think our next guest is in 2 weeks, and I believe it's transportation.
Great. Thanks, Christy. Okay, and I know Bethany had to hop off. Is there anyone with the Benefits and Policy Committee that would like to provide an update?
I think there were six of us that were actually able to attend, so it was more a discussion than actually
you did.
moving a whole lot forward. Carl was talking about his adoption resolution again, but Carl's out sick, so he can't really speak on that right now.
Great. Thank you, Danielle. Okay, and Wendy with the Elections Committee.
Well, as Sophie alluded to, the spring 2024 election materials went online last Friday, March 1st. The registration deadline is Friday the 22nd. There will be an info session for candidates on Tuesday, March 26th from 12 to 12:45. Voting will start on Thursday, April 11th, and will end at noon on Monday, April 15th, with results Tuesday the 16th, and our new EA members joining us for the EA meeting on Wednesday, April 17th. In conjunction with our own EA election, the employee elected trustee election will be taking place as well. So that will be on the same ballot as ours. The information for that is, if you go to the elections portion of the assembly's website and select employee, you'll see spring EA election and then spring EE election. The dates are a little different. There's an info session, thank you very much, Office of the Assembly, and there's that information there. So yeah, if you have any questions, you can reach out to me. If you have someone that approaches you and says, hey, I'm kind of interested, and what do I need to do, if you're not quite sure about how to answer the question or anything, you can point in my direction or help them out as best you can.
Excellent. All right. Thank you, Wendy. So now we're going to move on to liaison reports. Is there anyone who has an update from liaison committee? Okay. So now we'll move into the town hall debrief. Wendy, go ahead.
Oh, no, I just had something to add for the town hall debrief, but
okay,
go ahead first.
Yeah, nope. Just wanted to open it up for any last minute, any comments from last week's meeting. So Wendy, go ahead.
I unfortunately did not attend the town hall because I had some conflicting priorities, but I did want to mention to people that there is the Inclusive Excellence Summit. It's also actually being held virtually on Tuesday, March 26th. And there is a session in the afternoon from 1 to 2, and it's titled, I Can't Yell Fire, But What Can I Say? An Exploration of Free Speech in the Workplace. And it's being facilitated by Cooper Sarawaka, who is the Equal Opportunity Program Director in the Office of Institutional Equity and Title IX. I know we are kind of like, well, how does staff handle what they say or not, that sort of thing. So I think, if anyone's interested, I'm actually going to be attending that session. And then there's a session later about Don't Trust Yourself, Media Literacy in the Digital Age, just to kind of for my own benefit, but it might be helpful for others, or share that information with people as well.
Great. Thank you, Wendy. Yes, please do register. It's going to be a really informative day. Kyle, go right ahead.
Yeah, I just had feedback, since it's an open time to share it. And this is from, not me, because I knew it was happening, but I talked to a lot of my colleagues, and then I had my first open office hours for Cal's people, and 3 people showed up, and I was so excited. So I got feedback from like 7 people, but pretty much no one that I talked to knew what it was. Like they were like, oh yeah, like I think I saw an email about that, but like they did not understand the gravity of what was being discussed. And I've been like encouraging them to go and leave comments, but maybe because of how like late the invitation came out, or just the fact that we get so many emails from Cornell and they all do kind of look the same because they're in the same format with the red and the white and the black. But just wanted to share that the communication for that event did not, I don't think it was successful, at least among the other people that I talked to who are outside of this group, as far as like rallying the general body to participate. But I don't have a solution for that. Unfortunately, I haven't really thought about it, but I just wanted to flag it.
Yeah. Thank you for that feedback. Anyone else have anything they'd like to discuss about the town hall? Yvonne, go right ahead.
Yes, a couple of thoughts. as the town hall was being was starting and being introduced, it almost sounded like they had communication with the EA, so this group here, prior to that town hall. And I don't know that that actually happened unless it was the executive group. And yeah, I guess I'll start with that.
Yeah. So I did have the intro, so I did work with them to help arrange it. And I, it was very planned very quickly. So it was, I think, within a week. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm.
Thank you. It just, as the other individuals talked about the policy, it just sounded that they had consulted with the EA. And that, you know, we were kind of in support of what was happening, when in reality, I, at least from my end, I have been hearing a lot of dissent and disagreement with the interim policy that is being, I guess, implemented now. And another thing, like, I don't know if we have further collaborations, and I hope that we do, in engaging more with this policy, if we can make the format a little bit more accessible to people, you know, being able to see who's present, being able to ask questions in the moment, being able to have the chat available. I don't, and maybe someone can share with me, like, is there any particular reasons why those features were not open to the public or to the community, I should say?
Yeah. Well, I know it was set up as a webinar. And there was a chat feature, but we did solicit comments in advance so they could be prepared, or, you know, so they could think about their responses. But we did try to get to as many responses as we could within that time frame. So I know that doesn't answer all of your questions. And I'm going to move over to the Office of Assemblies to see if Jessica has anything she would like to add pertaining to this, or maybe something else.
I was just going to mention that if you were not able to attend, or like me, I was not able to attend that meeting, the video of the employee and staff town hall and the video of the faculty town hall are linked on the interim policy change feedback page, which I posted the link to in chat. So if you haven't seen it, or know people who haven't seen it, it is available as a recording.
Great. Thank you, Jessica. Okay, Yvonne, anything else with that, or am I all set?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And Marcy, go right ahead.
Yeah, I think we had discussed and brought up the, if I'm understanding correctly, the actual proposal, or at least the interim, what everyone was discussing. And we had, I know we were given notice of it from like a week before. So, you know, I think Jana did send out an email to all of the EA asking if anyone had any, you know, a link to the actual proposal and actual, any comments or any thoughts for it. But yeah, we weren't given much notice at all either, unfortunately. And I think we did in the liaison reports discuss about the university assembly. It was kind of put in the hands of the university assembly, which is, you know, which there are some EA members here who are represented in the university assembly to discuss it. And it's been my experience anyway, of what I've heard of my people that I work with, they don't have much feedback on it. You know, at least that's what I'm hearing. That's just me. That's just my experience. I know staff and faculty do have other thoughts and are very vocal and feel very differently about it. But just me as a staff person, a lot of it just seems to make sense as far as, you don't keep notices up on, you don't post things on buildings, you don't keep signs up for more than 2 weeks. That's just something that we've always done, and I've seen for the past 20 years anyway at Cornell. So that's just my experience, but there are a lot of people that have a lot prouder feelings about it, and I'm not taking away from them, but it's just, as an employee, I don't protest. So other sanctions do, and other, you know, groups do, but, and like I said, other people have different thoughts, but it has been discussed a bunch of times though.
Thanks, Marcy. Okay, Jeremy, go right ahead.
So I feel like we have seen recently a few examples of significant policy changes that do impact staff where the EA has not been consulted or involved in any way, or not until it's a fait accompli and, you know, a week from arrival. I'm thinking of the changes to the inclement weather policy as another example. And I would not like to see that trend continue. So I think that as a body, we should be thinking about how to have conversation with our leadership to ensure that we stay involved in changes that will impact staff significantly before they become public and doing direct impact. If nothing else, so we can better communicate the reasoning behind the decisions that are made to our constituencies.
Yeah, absolutely. Marcy, go ahead.
So sorry to set talk again, but yes, I completely agree. And we had that conversation, actually we had that conversation just because we're just a couple of people in the EA are invited to speak with higher, you know, like, well, Christine Lee. And we did mention the, you know, the weather policy was the one that I felt deeply impacted us. And we weren't given the opportunity to really discuss it prior. And we did let them know. So, you know, hopefully that won't happen again, or at least there'll be a little bit more conversations. And I believe they did tell us that, you know, there is a, you know, they do talk to the policy. Jana, maybe you recall better. And Wendy, to just discuss future policy changes and things that really do impact us.
Yeah, they did. I know in our leadership meeting, they did specify that they would take a greater role in working with us and collaborating. So that is something that they will plan on doing moving forward. Unfortunately, those two policies just it didn't exactly happen the way we would have liked. Okay, well, we have 2 minutes. I'm going to move on to... Well, is there anything else for the town hall? If not, we have a very small window for open discussion. If there's anything, Marcy?
Sorry, did anyone else have any thoughts about it? I know I would like to gather more. I think we should gather more feedback. Did anyone else have other feelings about the proposed? I mean, it's still an interim policy. It's not a policy yet. I believe the conversations for, or at least the feedback, has already gone through. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Okay, thank you. Erica.
Just really quick, I think that there needs to be some clarification around the interim policies because they are right going into effect. So they are not just stagnant policies. People are being, well, students rather, are being referred to our office for things within that policy, right? So I think that if we're truly going to have interim policies coming from the top down, right, we need to know if these are interim policies that are going to be active until they're, I guess, codified in some way, or if these are just policies that are on the table for discussion about revision. Like, that needs to be clear so we understand what we're doing as a larger community, because we are essentially the enforcers of said policy. Right. So how are we supposed to enforce something that we don't know whether or not it's active or just lying dormant for discussion and revision?
Okay. Thank you, Erica. And Yvonne?
Very briefly. Thank you, Erica, for that. Very briefly, I would like to say that during the town hall, the so-called town hall, there is no actual clarification on how this policy is going to be implemented and either impact or protect staff. And so that's alarming because, like Erica said, it is being implemented now and it is going to have very direct impacts on staff being able to use their freedom of expression. But there was no clarification on what we can actually do, say, when, where in our private lives at work. And how that was going to be addressed, for lack of better words.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we are running out of time. Jeremy, I'll let you have one question and then Marcy.
I was just going to say that that directly ties into the conversations that we started within the education committee around staff use of social media and what protections, if any, we have on private social media use.
Just real quickly, I'm so sorry, I'm speaking out of turn. Sorry, Jenna.
No, you're go right ahead.
Okay, sorry. We did, I think it's been asked so many times, what can we do to protect ourselves? What can we do to, you know, still have the ability to have free speech or at least speak freely? And yes, the education committee is something that someone, you know, it's going to be talked about anyway. And we've tried, I think it was asked during the town hall. But yeah, it wasn't answered, but it was asked.
I looked at Nina's stuff. Thanks. Unfortunately, we are probably not going to get through open discussion. I welcome any additional comments. I think the portal for feedback is probably closed at this point. So if you have any other feedback, please send it to me, Marcy, the executive committee, Wendy, Kate, Sophie, any one of us, and we'll make sure that that is submitted for further consideration. At this time, I welcome a motion to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn.
Second.
Great. Thanks, Jeremy. All right. Thank you so much, everyone. Bye-bye. See you next.